Our speaker tonight is John from There Is a Solution Group in Philadelphia, right?
My name is John. I am an alcoholic. Wow, what a nice crowd. Where did all you people come from? On my way here, I saw like three houses. And there's like 200 people here. You can't all be living together. Never expected this many people. I do come from Northeast Philadelphia. There is a solution group. It's actually going on right now. It's an hour, 15-minute meeting. It starts at 7 o'clock. It's at St. Luke's Church on Welsh Road between Busselton and Roosevelt Boulevard. If you're ever in the area on a Monday night and you're not here, stop on by. Whew. All right, where do I start? You know, I ask myself on the way here, like, how did I get here? I know I took a GPS to get here, but really, like, how did I get here? From a guy that was at a place that I was at, to be standing in front of all you people trying to carry some type of message, trying to do some type of service to the God of my understanding, is that nothing I had planned. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you think you know what lies ahead of you, I stand here before you and I assure you that you don't. You do not. I had no idea what lied ahead of me. Good times, bad times, difficult times, easy times. But they were all necessary. They were all necessary. You know, I always wanted to be one of them funny, funny speakers. Sorry to say, I'm not. So, you know, if you were looking for a funny speaker, you're not going to get one here tonight. And that was the thing of my whole life. I always wanted to be something or somebody that I'm not. It's the way I lived my entire life. I molded myself to what I thought you would want to be, or that who she would date, or this crowd would like. Because if you really got to know who I was, you would leave me. I always lived in that fear. And I would reinvent myself. When I was with the drinkers in school, I'd be like a drunk. And then when I was with the potheads, I would be like a head. And then when I was hanging with the jocks, I'd be like a jock. But they all got together on a Friday night, and I didn't know what to be. And that's just the way it went. You know, just a quick little story. I was 9 months sober, 9 months in recovery, and I was having my first naval birthday. And I sat down and I made myself a T-bone steak and a fresh Idaho potato and fresh steamed broccoli. And where I came from, that was a big deal. Because where I left off, I was just living on bouillon cubes, potatoes that had things growing out of them, and a case of oranges my brother sent up from Florida for Christmas. But I sat down at that table and had a candlelight dinner with myself for my birthday. And I started to cry. Because I sat at that table and I had no idea who I was. I had no idea who I was sitting down with. Because my whole life I was trying to be what I thought you wanted to be rather than who I was. So I really never ever got to know who John was. But at the same time, I knew that I was embarking on a journey to where I was going to find out who I was. And to this very day, I'm still finding out. I'm still learning more. I'm still developing that relationship with myself. And it's a pretty cool thing. And I like who I am. I really do. But just to give you a little background, I'm the youngest of four boys. I just spent the weekend with my three older brothers and my mother. My father's passed. I was raised by two deaf mutes. And that was something different growing up. Don't know what it's like to have a conversation with my father while the ball game's on. It just didn't happen. We never knew sign language. We just had our basic communication. You know, what time's dinner? Am I allowed to go out? Do I have to do my homework? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yada, yada, yada. Does any of that stuff make me an alcoholic? Absolutely not. That's just the life that was dealt me. And that's just the way it was. It was different. And I stand up here, knowing the way I was as a child, I was ashamed of my parents because they were different than everybody else's. You know, and when we were out in public and they couldn't speak right, you weren't looking at them, you were looking at me. Like, look at that kid with the freak for parents. You know what I mean? And I've come to know my parents are absolutely beautiful people. But it just didn't feel that way as a kid. So, that's the way I grew up. That's the type of household I grew up in. And like I said, I was the youngest of four boys, so I got my ass thoroughly whipped constantly. Yelled for help, and never help never came because Mom couldn't hear me. So, just to get on with my life, I picked up my first drink at the age of 11. And I had no idea that I was going to go on an 18-year progressive journey with alcohol. Didn't see it coming. I thought I knew what was coming. Had no idea what was coming. I didn't start out as an alcoholic. I wasn't an everyday drinker, but it was something that slowly developed. Where that line crossed, I have no idea. But all I know is I did cross it because there came a day where drinking was a necessity. Just became a necessity. And, you know, I blew a lot of good times. I don't like to get into a whole long drunkalog. We all have our histories. They're all similar, but they're all different. But some of the things that have taken place in my life, that alcohol just robbed me. Just robbed me of a lot of things. You know? And the alcohol, like I said, it got to the point where, and I didn't even know it. I always thought I was able to control it, thought I was controlling it, thought I was drinking because I wanted to drink. And that really wasn't the case. You know? And what comes to mind was the day I was going to have my first child. I didn't know it. My wife's water broke 7 weeks early. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm in the parking lot out at work, in my work parking lot, drinking with the guys. You know, my wife's water broke, and word finally got to me, and I went home, and I took her to the hospital, and I was so drunk. When I did take her to the hospital, nurses said, you know what? We don't need you here. She's not going to deliver anytime soon. Why don't you just go home and sleep this off? You know, but that's the kind of guy I was. It really wasn't who I was, but it's what I was. You know, a man with a wife at home, 7 months pregnant, and I'm in the middle of a parking lot at 2 a.m. drinking. And that was an every night occurrence. So I did go home that night. And I came back at 10 o'clock in the morning. My wife delivered my first child at 6 o'clock that evening. And I'd like to stand here before you and say I stood by her side and held her hand while she was getting ready to deliver my first child. And that's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to do. I left that woman in the hospital to go have a drink. To go have a drink. That's the power of booze in my life. That's the power of booze. I did get back to see my child born, thank God. But after that child was born, I was out celebrating that night, doing what a drunk does, using the birth of my child as an excuse just to go on a tear. But, you know, what I'm getting from all that is, you know, what's standing before you is a very imperfect person. I'm perfectly imperfect, though. And it's really important for me to realize that. Because if I can look back and I can beat myself up over and over and over again. But the fact remains, I always wanted to do the right thing. Inside, there is a good person. And that good person was never able to come out. And I believe that for all of us. I was just never able to just be who and what I wanted to be. Rather than just being another alcoholic on the bus. And that's what I was. I was trying to be responsible. Alcohol wouldn't allow it. You know, that same child, and a year later or 18 months later, I was to have another child. Same situation. The day of my wedding, I'm on the altar because I was out all night the night before. Because I picked up one drink at my mother's house the night before. Never went to bed. And I remember, and it burned vividly into my memory, That priest turned in his head because I was making a mockery in his church on what was supposed to be a very important day in my life, because I was drunk as a skunk. No condition to be up there taking wedding vows. But that's how I showed up to the church. You know, and that was just kept rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling. And I was just never able to be who I wanted to be. That person that I am was never able to come out. Sad to say. I ruined a lot of good moments of my life and of those people that are around me. So, needless to say, there was a lot of amends to be made when I got up to the ninth step. But I found myself in my first rehab in 1991. A guy in work came to me and said, "Listen, if you don't go to rehab on Monday morning, they're going to come to you and you're going to lose your job. But if you go away now, they won't be able to touch your job." And I said, "Well, it sounds like a good idea to go away." So I went away that weekend. While I was away, I kind of got the understanding of who and what I was. You know, I'm an alcoholic, but I got a king-size problem with alcohol. They allowed me to see things I was incapable of seeing. And I did my 28 days, and I got out of there, and I stayed sober for the next 6 months. And I loved it. And I was having great, great moments. And I was able to get my house out of foreclosure. I was able to get my job back. I was even able to get my family back because my family said, you know, we had enough. All them things started to materialize. You know, on page 35 of our big book, they talk about a man we should call Jim. And the description in that experience is they take Jim through steps 1, 2, and 3. And what happens to Jim is he gets his family back. He gets his job back. And he stops. And that's exactly what I did. And it says to his consternation, which means to his amazement, he finds himself drunk a half a dozen times in succession. And that's my experience. I had that same exact experience. I started work at 4 o'clock. My shift was 4 to 12. And at 8 o'clock was my lunch hour. And I had no idea when I went to work that day that that was going to be the day. It was like any other day. Things were going well. 7:30, half hour before lunch, the thought came into my mind, wouldn't it be nice to have one at lunch? Didn't say nothing to anybody. You know, wasn't using anything. 8 o'clock came. Where did I go? I went to the tap room down the corner. I'd like to stand here and say I had one, but I'm a real alcoholic, so I had 3. Made it back to work at 8:30. Now, my MO prior to going away to rehab was I never did a full week's worth of work. I always came in late or I left early. It was ridiculous. But since coming home from the rehabilitation center, I had perfect attendance. Always on time, always stayed my full shift. In fact, they had to throw me out every night because I would work all the overtime that I could. And I never missed a day. So I come back from that bar after having 3 drinks. And within 20 minutes, I was in my supervisor's office telling him I had a bad sandwich and I had to go. I had to go. There was no way that I could finish out that shift. I had to go. And within 60 minutes, I had everything. Within 60 minutes, I picked up the cigarettes again, picked up the booze, picked up the dry goods, picked up the women. It was just, I was off to the races. And I returned home at 3 o'clock in the morning just to re-up for some money. You know, with people out in my car, my kids sleeping upstairs, my wife in bed, and she's saying, "What's going on?" I said, "I got to go." And she couldn't believe me. You know, it's a funny thing. I married my wife because she was just like me. Just like me. If you would have asked me, she was a worse drinker than I was. She would have been the alcoholic. You know, but in our big book, it talks about the real alcoholic. It talks about the heavy drinker and the moderate drinker. You know, given good sufficient reason, a heavy drinker will be able to revert back to a moderate drinker or even stop. but the real alcoholic won't be. See, because me and my wife were both given the same set of situations. We were both going to bring a child into this world. We were both getting married. And we were both getting a house. And we were going to build a home together. They were all good, strong, sufficient reasons to change my drinking and her. She was able to revert back to a moderate drinker, even though she was worse than me. And this is 26 years later, and she's still a moderate drinker. I, on the other hand, progressively increased my drinking. And that's the description of a real alcoholic. And I stand before you, a real alcoholic. You know, I told you I picked up that drink that night. I was to go on, it was a 6-month drink. It wasn't 6 ounces, it was 6 months. It started 3 days before Mother's Day, and my last drink was December 26, 1992. And it all started with that one thought a half hour before lunchtime. You know, during the course of that 6 months, my wife said, if you don't drink, stop drinking. Me and the kids are leaving. That's a good, strong, sufficient reason not to drink. What do you think I did? I drank. My employer came to me and said, if you come in drunk again, we are taking this mighty fine job that you have. And it was a great, great job. We're taking this job from you. What do you think I did? I came in drunk. My mortgage company said, if you do not pay the mortgage, we are going to take your home. What do you think I did with the money? I drank. All great, good, sufficient reasons not to drink. I wanted to do the right thing yet again and couldn't. See, I'm powerless over alcohol. It tells me what to do, when to do it, where to do it, who to do it with, and how to do it. And it just, I have no control. I have absolutely none when it comes to combating alcohol. No matter how great the wish, no matter how strong the will, it's of no avail. Absolutely none. I stand before you. When I got up this morning, I had no more power over alcohol than I did December 26, 1992. I don't possess it. I just don't possess it. I can't generate it. It's something that I have to tap into on a daily basis. And that's why I'm here. First thing I do, I get up in the morning. I get on my knees. And I connect with a power greater than myself. I try and follow some type of good orderly direction, which are on the wall behind me. G-O-D. That's another source of power that I get. And I try to plug into a group of drunks. And I can't sit here and say that there's not a power here. Look at this. I'm in the middle of nowhere. There's 200 people out here not drinking. There's a power. There is a power. And I have to tap into that. Because by myself, I do not generate it. Regardless of how long I have been sober. I just don't have it. And the moment I think that I have power, it's the moment that I don't need you, I don't need these steps, and I don't need God. And let's see how far I get then. So that's the deal. That's the deal. You know, so I went on that 6 month relapse, and I lost my wife, my job, my car, my home, and most importantly, I lost my mind. At the end of December 1992, the greatest idea that could come through this mind was to take my own life. And I made that decision. I'm not standing here in front of you because I made some great decision to come to AA. I knew what AA was about, but I didn't make the decision to come back. I made the decision to take my life. I'm only standing in front of you because a power greater than myself did for me what I could not do for myself through other people. And that's the only reason why I'm standing here. Left to my own devices, I would have been gone a long time ago. You know, and what preceded my getting sober was at the end of that, I had gotten my last paycheck right before Christmas. And I told you, I always wanted to do the right thing. And I took that last paycheck, and I brought gifts for my children. and for a drunk to take his last dollars that he knows that he's going to receive and spend it on somebody other than himself is a huge task. I did that. I don't know where it came from, but I did it. I always wanted to do the right thing. I always wanted to be a good person, a healthy person. So I took that check, and I bought gifts for the kids for Christmas. I wrapped them up. I put them in two trash bags. My car was gone, so I took two buses to get to my wife's father's house because that's where her and the kids had moved because they needed to get away from me. I arrived on that doorstep. I knocked on that door with two bags of gifts, doing what was so hard to do, and that was the right thing. She opened the door. She looked at me dead in the eye, and I said, "Judy, I said, I went out and I got these gifts for the kids. I want to be a part of Christmas." And this is on Christmas Eve, 1992. She took the two bags of gifts, and she said, "We don't want you. We don't want you." She looked me dead in the eye. And I said, "Well, if you don't want me and I can't be a part of, well, then there's no reason for me to live." And she looked me square in the eye again. And she said, "Well, if you're going to kill yourself, just don't do it on this doorstep." And it sounds like a dark, lonely place. Sounds sad. She was doing what was best for her and her children. And little did she know, she was doing what was best for me. And I had no idea until some time later. It was when I was all out of options, all out of places to go, all out of people, was then that something was able to take place in my life. And that's exactly what took place. You think it's a coincidence that 2 days later was my last drink? I don't. I was all out of options, and there was only one place to go, and that was vertical. Or I could have went horizontal. I chose to go down into the grave. So I started talking to my maker. I wasn't going to do it on Christmas. I wasn't going to do it the day after Christmas, but I wasn't bringing in New Year's. I'll tell you that right now. So I started talking to God, and God was listening the whole time. He took me and did what He willed with me. And I was praying for that, except I was praying to take me up. He was praying. He took and did this. And that's my story. And then I was to go on to this next chapter of my journey. You know, it's funny because I found myself in a rehabilitation center that I came out of the first time. And I was in such a dark, lonely place. I was in there for 6 days and they said, "You have to go. We can't treat you." They actually kicked me out for being too sick. They didn't have the resources. So the building trains of Philadelphia came up and got me. And they didn't know what to do with me. So they dropped me off at a psychiatric hospital. They didn't have no room for me. And they said, "Well, we can't take them. We don't know what to do with them." They said, "We're leaving them here." So they put me on a gurney. I stayed on the gurney for 2 days outside the nurse's station because they had no beds. And then once a room opened up, it was the suicidal room, opened up right across from the nurse's station. They put me in there. And I laid in there for the next couple days. And one morning I woke, and there was a plaque on the nightstand next to the bed. I don't know where it came from. I asked every nurse. I asked the patients. Nobody knows anything about this plaque. And this plaque still stays on my nightstand today. And it's called The Difference. And it talked about the difference between asking and not asking, between seeking and not seeking. Something took place when I read that morning. I rolled out of that bed and I got on my knees and I prayed like I never prayed ever in my entire life. It wasn't about the wife. It wasn't about the job. It wasn't about the home. It wasn't about nothing except me and God. And I asked Him for help. And I really wanted Him to be there for when I took my own life. And it's my experience that I have not been the same man since. Something happened in that moment of true, utter abandonment to a God. And it's been an amazing journey. And that's why I'm here tonight. You know, on page 164, it says, great events will come to pass. And my story is loaded with them. And if we all look at our own stories, we'll be able to see them, to see the transformation that has taken place from a drunk to a recovering alcoholic who wants to service his God, who wants to service his fellowship, and the things that take place along the way. You know, I'd like to sit here and say I did everything right and perfect since the day I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I haven't. I'm perfectly imperfect. You know, I love the big book because it tells you what you're going to do and what you're going to experience as a result of. It's loaded with promises right after the directions that they give you. But the step book, on the other hand, is going to tell me everything that I'm going to not do and the price I'm going to pay as a result of. Withholding on step five. Half measures. You know, the two-step illusion. Boy meets girl on AA campus. Love follows at first sight. I did them all. If you read them books, you know me inside and out. The good and the bad. Like I said, I'm not perfect, and I don't want to stand up here and sound like I am, because I'm far from it. I'm human, and I've come to accept my humanness. And Alcoholics Anonymous and you people have allowed me to get there. My story, I was like one of you that are sitting out there right now. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years, slowly dying of untreated alcoholism. I was amongst you. I looked just like you. Nobody could tell. I blended right in like I did my whole life. At 8 years without a drink, I didn't want to drink, but I didn't want to live. And I came up with this great idea to pack my two kids up, drive 1,300 miles to South Florida, and take them to visit their family for the very last time. I was the only one privy to this information. The only one. And that's what I did. Now, my brother, he's got 5 more years of sobriety than I do, and he had very good sobriety. Good South Florida sobriety. And I was down there for 2 weeks. And I was acting this whole thing out, seeming fine, just like I did in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I was getting ready to get in the car, he sensed something wasn't right with me. And he said, I don't know what's wrong with you. He says, and I can't stop you from going back up north. He says, but I'm going to stop you from putting them two kids in that car. And right at that moment, God had entered my life yet again. And I had a complete collapse right there. Like a moment of honesty, and I actually told them what was going on. A moment of honesty came through this dishonest body. See, because when I live in that make pretend, I'm being dishonest with the world and those about. And he did what any other good AA member would do. He said, let me help you. And I proceeded to stay in the state of Florida for the next 6 months. They wouldn't allow me to leave. He took me to a doctor, but more importantly, he took me to the Coral Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Coral Room. And he introduced me to a guy, Jim M. And Jim M. looked me right in the eye, and he said, has anybody ever taken you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? And when Jim looked me in the eye, I looked at Jim's shoes, and I said, I haven't drank in 8 years. I was like this. And Jim turned to me and said, I didn't ask you that question. He said, I asked you, has anyone taken you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? Again, he looked me in the eye. And when he looked me in the eye, I looked at his shoes. And Jimmy had really nice shoes. He was well-dressed. Had these nice penny loafers. Never forget them. Was kind of jealous. But I said, Jim, I said, I'm the chairman of my home group. I sponsor guys. I make meetings every day. And he said, that's not the question I asked you. Third time, Jim asked me, has anybody taken you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? And once again, my God arrived and allowed the moment of honesty to come through this dishonest body. And he said, has anybody taken you through? And the third time, I broke out in tears and I said, no. Jim put his hand on my shoulder very gently. And he says, you're going to be okay. He says, I want to take you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to be okay. And I believed them. And I got goosebumps running up and down my arms and legs, because that was another changing moment, just like that changing moment that I had when I read that plaque, The Difference. Another major changing moment. Jim proceeded to take me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here to tell you that my life, everything about me, my recovery has not been the same since that time. It's been night and day. And if you're sitting out there like I was sitting out there, I hope you hear this message. Please, if you haven't gone through the steps and you're resisting them or you're shying away from them or you're hiding from them, please get with a sponsor who knows about the steps and ask him or her to take you through. It was a major difference. And then I was going to go on to continue on my journey. And God just kept repeatedly showing up in my life. Just repeatedly showing up in my life. You know, like I said, it says great events will come to pass. And that's just been my story. You know, I come back home. I start plugging in. I get a sponsor who's all about the steps. And I've started working with him. And things are just going grand. They really are. And I'm growing. I'm growing in this process. You know, that same woman that I told you about, I lost her home, put her and her children out on the street and all that stuff. We were just talking prior to the meeting. That woman's my best friend today. Like, I don't know. I'm here to bear witness that this stuff really works. Because how's a woman turn around and befriend a person like that that did that to her? Only through profound change. It wasn't my words. It was my actions. You know, and as I started going through this book, I started to come alive in a lot of areas. I started to realize what and how deep this disease is within me. And that the bottle was only a symptom. That I suffered from a much greater thing. And we're going to get to that. You know, step two happened when I first got out of the rehab. I went to a meeting. It was like my third day out. And I knew the whole God idea and all that other stuff, but I didn't understand how God could really help me, because it was just something that I prayed to. And I was praying to it, and I realized something was taking place. But how could he help me with my alcoholism? I went to a meeting. This was my third day out. It was at the Christ the King meeting up on Moreau Avenue in Northeast Philadelphia. And I walked into that meeting that night, and I looked over, and I saw this guy, Brian L., or what appeared to be this guy, Brian L. This guy, Brian, was the worst alcoholic I have ever seen. He was the neighborhood drunk, and he was beyond anything you could ever imagine. His family had a nice home, but he lived in the woods in an abandoned car, showered in the creek, shaved in the creek, and I never saw the guy take a sober breath. We used to call him Pick, because he could stumble, scrape his shoulder, and not fall down. And that was his everyday occurrence. But when I walked into that meeting that night, and I looked over and I saw Brian, it wasn't the same man. And I couldn't believe it. And I said, if this could happen to Brian, then it has to be able to work for me, because Brian was so much worse than I was. And it was at that moment that I came to believe. I came to believe that what was working for you guys could work for me. So step two started to grab a hold. I believed in this power. It could work for me. See, it wasn't knowing what was wrong with me. I can know what's wrong with me, and that's not going to do a damn thing. Knowledge avails me nothing. Cemeteries, prisons, they're loaded with people who knew what was wrong with them but continued to drink. Knew they were alcoholic, but yet continued to drink. The knowledge does nothing. You know, in my belief, this whole deal, when I say, how did I get here? God. It's one word. When I really sum up this program, what's the one deal? It's about connecting with the God of my own understanding. AA constantly sends me to God. And that night, when I saw Brian, I believed in this power that would work in my life. And then when I got to step three, I made this decision. I made this decision. I like to say I started right with it, but I didn't. But I did make a decision to stay sober and try and plug into what you guys were plugging into, and that was Scott. Did I do it perfectly? No. Did I do it in the proper time frame? Yeah, my proper time frame, but I wish it was different. Really do. But anyhow, so anyway, I start working with Jim, and Jim starts to take me through the steps. You know, and I saw the controlness that I possess. You know, I always tried to play God. Always went to war every day, trying to make you do what I wanted you to do, think the way I wanted you to think, in my little sneaky, conniving ways. That's just who and what I am. You know, and I'll be the nicest person in the world. I have the ability to be the most kindest, gentlest, sweetest, lovingest guy in the world. But sad to say, most of the time it's because I want something out of you. I will give you all my virtues because I want you to be on my side, or I want you to do, or not be able to say no when I ask for something. And that's the way I lived my life. And when you didn't, I would shut you out. I'd be mean. You know, I'd strike fear into you. Whatever it took to get you to do what I wanted you to do. I love page 61. It describes me to a T. And when I'm disturbed, it's usually because of page 61. You're not behaving according to John. Just is. And most of my sponsees, when they come to me, we revert right back to page 61. Somebody's not doing or speaking or thinking the way that they want them to think. And it's usually one of their sponsees. So then I finally, after all these years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I take a fearless and thorough moral inventory of me. My whole life I was taking yours, but I finally took mine. And what an eye-opener. Because it was then that I saw I was selfish, self-centered, fearful, lustful, dishonest, insecure. I mean, the list just went on and on and on and on and on. And in step five, I stood there like I was fully naked. I finally saw myself for the very first time. Like I never saw myself. And when I saw myself like that, that's not who I started out to be. That's not who I wanted to be. So with that came a willingness to ask God for help. Because I was taught that I can't possibly remove a defect of character. I love hearing people say, I'm working on my character defects. I don't know. I ask God. My job is to become willing and to humbly ask Him. And that's what I did in step seven. I got to step eight. I learned about forgiveness. And I learned how I had to forgive somebody before asking for forgiveness. And I was sexually abused, and I had to learn how to forgive that man who sexually abused me as a child. I had to forgive him, because I learned that in step four. I had to see him from a different perspective. I had to see him for being a sick person, because a healthy person wouldn't do that to a child. Just like I did a lot of bad things to people, because I was unhealthy too. And step nine, I started going around making amends for the wrongs that I had done. And I love my step nine story. Once again, I was 1,300 miles away from home. There was a person that was atop my A-step list I wanted to make amends to so bad. And that was even prior to coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I so bad wanted to see this person and make things right. It's about 13 years sober now. I'm 1,300 miles away from home. And God's going to enter my life yet again. I'm at my brother's house. It's about 25 minutes from the choral room. And I'm not going to go because it's 5 to 12 and the meeting starts at 12 o'clock and I don't want to walk in late. For whatever reason, when I made that decision, a loud voice started going off in my head that I couldn't shut off and I couldn't ignore. And it said a half a meeting is better than no meeting. And I heard that at AA sometime prior. But for whatever reason, at that moment, it just would not stop. So I proceeded to go to that meeting. I walked in around 12:30. I got a cup of coffee at the coffee bar. I sat down. I look across the room, and lo and behold, the person that's on the top of my A-step list is 1,300 miles away from my neighborhood, which we grew up in, and the moment was right there. I couldn't put that together. I could not put that together. And after that meeting, I got to make that amend. And I'd like to sit here and say that amend felt good, but it didn't, because I saw the pain and the damage that I caused in another person's life. But what I did get to witness was a healing within her, because I allowed her to talk, because I was told to ask, do you need to say anything? And then shut up and listen. And I did that, and I watched the healing take place. Couldn't change it, but I was allowed a moment to allow her to heal. And it was an awesome experience. I remember getting in my car, and my hands wouldn't leave the steering wheel. I called my sponsor, I called my brother, I called my best friend, and told him what had just taken place. Like God had arrived in my life again. And in step 10, I try and incorporate all these steps into my life on a daily basis to keep my spiritual condition fit, so that way the drink stays away. See, that's the promises of step 10. If I practice 4 through 9, the alcohol problem is removed. And then in step 11, if I continually seek Him, evening, morning, and during the day, the 11 step promises at the end of that chapter tells me that I'm going to be less likely to be resentful, fearful, full of anxiety. My character defects start to be removed as a result of. But it's continual progress. I have so many God moments that I would love to share with you guys, and I could keep you here all night. I really could, because God has just constantly showed up in my life. I could not have written a story that I have lived. There's no way possible. I can't put a plan like this together. I just can't. But the beauty of it is I've got to live it. I've got to experience it. You know, tomorrow, my mom's been up for 4 months. I picked her up in Florida. She doesn't like to fly alone, so I flew down on May 28th to South Florida. I picked her up to fly her back. But I was there for one night and one night only. I flew in on Tuesday. I was flying her back up on a Wednesday. So I had 24 hours. So I was there. I said, you know what? I'm going to go over to the EDI clubhouse for the 6 o'clock meeting, the happy hour group. And I went over to that meeting, and I raised my hand. I said, my name is John. I'm from There's a Solution group in Philadelphia, and I'm an alcoholic. And they all welcomed me just like you guys did. You know, I'd love that you receive an AA. But more importantly, after that meeting was over, so we all gathered around in a circle, a guy rushed across the room to stand next to me. And he grabbed a hold of my hand. And he says, your name's John. I said, yeah. He says, you're from Philadelphia. I said, yeah. I said that in the beginning of the meeting. He reached into his pocket. And he pulled out what we know as the green card. Now, if you've never seen a green card, it's Southeastern Pennsylvania Intergroup. It's only in this area of the country. You won't find them anywhere else. He said, 2.5 years ago, you sat with me over in that corner when your dad was sick, and you were down here for your dad. And I had just come into the room, and you gave me this green card. The guy still carries it every day. It was underlined. It was highlighted. He says, I photographed this to help my sponsees today. God revealed himself to me yet again. I had no idea that night. See, when I do the best work is when God's using me and I don't even know it. It's when I don't even know it. Yeah, I can go around with a fireman's hat on. But you know what? The most greatest work that has taken place in my life has come when I didn't know it. And I'm going to leave you with this last final God moment. My daughter was missing for 1.5 years. She took a walk one morning. And We didn't hear from her for a year and a half. No phone call, no sighting, no nothing. Didn't know she was dead or alive. That was a very tough time in my recovery. But I found some type of peace in prayer and meditation and through working with others and through practicing these steps and through hanging out with you guys. A peace that I could not describe. I was okay. I was sitting on the beach. It's in August. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take off for 6 months from work, get in my car, and I want to visit all these spiritual places because I was craving connecting with God in a deeper, deeper, deeper sense. And I said, I want to do this. That's not the way it worked out. You know, wish I could have took off for 6 months, but that's where my thought was, sitting on the beach. But the fact remains is in February, I'm on my computer, and that's still that same craving, seeking God more and more. But for whatever reason, I booked this vacation to Mesa, Arizona. One-bedroom suite, sitting on a golf course. This hotel sits on the golf course. Beautiful as can be. After I booked it, I had no idea why I booked it. I don't know what the hell's in Mesa, Arizona. I have no clue what's in Mesa, Arizona. You can tell me Sedona. You can tell me Flagstaff. You can tell me Phoenix. You can tell me all these other places. Mesa, Arizona, I never even heard of. Never even heard of the place. And I just booked a vacation there. So I start talking to my friends, start talking to my home group members, and I said, yeah, I'm going on this trip. They said, where are you going? I said, Mesa, Arizona. They said, what's there? I said, I have no idea. And I really didn't. They said, who are you going with? Going by myself. Now they're really looking at me strange. I said, I got this one-bedroom suite. It's on a golf course. Oh, you're going to play golf. I don't play golf. I said, but for whatever reason, I had this inner feeling that I'm going to find out what's in Mesa, Arizona when I get there. I fly to Mesa, Arizona. I fly into Phoenix, get my rental car, I drive down to Mesa, Arizona. It's the nighttime. I checked in. There's this old man. He's at the check-in counter. I check in. Very nice man. I go to bed that night, take my jacuzzi. You know, I had this big, beautiful place. I wake up the next day. I don't know what the hell to do. So I go out to the pool. I'm out at the pool, and there's the wives and the kids, and everybody's out at the pool having a good time, and me. The husbands are all playing golf, and I feel like, all right, what doesn't belong in this picture? It's me. It's wives and her children, and the husbands are playing golf, and I just don't fit in. So I go in, and that night, that same old man was working the counter. He was a really nice older gentleman. And I said, sir, I said, if there's one thing that one person would do in Mesa, Arizona, when they're in Mesa, Arizona, what would it be? He says, there's not a whole lot in Mesa, Arizona. He says, but if you really like scenery, he says, we have what you call the Superstition Mountains. If you take this highway to that highway to that highway, you'll find yourself in Apache Junction, and you'll be at the foothills to the Superstition Mountains. And your car will be on the edge of cliffs, thousands of feet up with no guardrail. But you'll see some of the most spectacular views you'll ever see in your entire lifetime. And the roadway is about 40 miles, and it's one lane. He says, if you can stomach them cliffs and your car being on the edge of just gravel, he says, I would go do that while you're in Mesa, Arizona. And I said, I love scenery, and it sounds like something that's right up my alley. I could go there and connect with God. So I come up with this great idea. I'm going to stop at an AA meeting at the foothills, and then I'm going to go up there. So I go to this meeting. It's a 12 o'clock meeting. I go in there. It's in a shopping mall. And shopping malls are in the L shape. I didn't know you're supposed to pull around back. Everybody pulls around back. You're not supposed to overload the front of the shopping center. I didn't know. So I go in the front door. I park my car in the front of the shopping center. I sit down. I take in this meeting. I put my hand up. I share. After the meeting, I go to the men's room because I'm going up on this wonderful drive. I walk out the front door. Everybody else walks out the back door. I'm different. I get in my car. I start my car up, getting ready to put it in drive. I look in my rearview mirror. There's a pickup truck exiting the parking lot. I see the brake lights come on. Then I see the reverse lights. And this pickup truck backs up right alongside my car. And this guy gets out of the driver's seat, comes around his truck to my driver's door. And as he approaches, I see tears streaming down his face. I roll down my window. He says, "I know you're in a rush, but can you spare a minute?" I said, "Buddy, I'll spare you all the time you need." And he says, "You didn't see me, but I was in that meeting. I was sitting behind you. And I looked for you after that meeting and couldn't find you." And he says, "My name's Tommy. I haven't had a drink in 28 days. I've been to 15 meetings. And I've never introduced myself to anyone. But for some reason, when you put your hand up and you spoke, I was supposed to introduce myself to you." And Tommy proceeded to tell me that he lived two counties over, had never been to that meeting before because he didn't want anybody to see him, didn't know how he got there or anything like that. And I was able to proceedingly tell Tommy, I said, "I'm 2,500 miles away from home and didn't know what I was doing here until just this second." Me and Tommy stood in that parking lot and we talked recovery for the next hour and a half. And then me and Tommy connected the following day. Tommy stayed sober. That has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with God and His plan. All I did was showed up. But these are the kind of experiences that you get to experience by doing this deal and coming around to Alcoholics Anonymous. Moments like that, you just can't put a price tag on. And you see what the real worth of life is. And you get to experience things like that. And in the end, it's all about connecting with God. It's my belief. That's all I got. Thank you, and God bless.